Hi and welcome everyone. I'm Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist of StaceyBarr.com and your host for our Measures and More Mastermind program at measuresandmore.com. This is our August 2009 case study webcast and it's with M. William Sermons from the National Alliance for Ending Homelessness. And our topic today is measuring outcomes to end homelessness. Meaningful measures for program outcomes from the National Alliance for Ending Homelessness. And I'll introduce Bill just in a few minutes a little bit more formally. I first came across this model for measuring program outcomes via one of your fellow Measures and More members, Peter Clark. G'day, Peter. I know you're listening today. Who sent me the link to a special report that the National Alliance for Ending Homelessness had produced. And I was so impressed that I contacted the Alliance and ended up inviting Bill Sermons to be our August case study. And we're so fortunate that he said yes. Measuring program outcomes, particularly in human services, is a challenge because the results that matter enough to measure are also the softer results, the less tangible results. And they're very difficult to quantify, or at least that's most people's experience. But the Alliance have a model that works brilliantly for their homelessness program outcomes. And it's a model that every one of us can learn from, whether you're interested in homelessness or ending homelessness, or whether you're interested in some other kind of important outcome of your program that seems intangible and difficult to measure. So today we're going to cover several points. Firstly, the outputs and outcomes the Alliance decided were worth measuring for ending homelessness and how they decided on these. We're going to look at the simple formula that the Alliance used to measure outcome performance, and it's a formula you'll be able to use as well for your program outcomes. We'll look at examples of measures used for various programs contributing to that vision of ending homelessness, like prevention, emergency shelter, permanent supportive housing, employment training, and whatever Bill chooses to talk about, really. We'll also look at how the performance measures for ending homelessness are used to ensure that those programs are working, and also how to evaluate the success of a program in a broader context than just the measures, because often there are so many factors outside of our control, like economic conditions, and it's important to take those into account. So now, let me introduce you to Bill Sermons. M. William Sermons, Director of the Alliance's Homelessness Research Institute, specializes in cross-disciplinary research and program evaluation. And as Director of the Homelessness Research Institute, he's responsible for advancing the Institute's aim of building and disseminating knowledge that informs policy and practice. Prior to joining the Alliance, Bill served as Director of Outcomes at Mary's Center for Maternal and Child Care Incorporated, where he evaluated the organization's health, education, and social service programs, and also coordinated performance improvement efforts. He's a graduate of Duke University, holds a Master of Social Work degree from Catholic University, and also a PhD from Northwestern University. And as our real-life case study guest, Bill Sermons will share the Alliance's approach for measuring the outcomes of homelessness programs. Bill, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us from Washington, D.C. today.
Thank you, Stacey. I'm glad to be here.
Bill, I'm just thinking a really good way to warm everybody up might be for you to give us a little bit of background about the National Alliance for Ending Homelessness and also the Alliance's Homelessness Research Institute. Would you like to do that? Give us a bit of background about what it's about and what it does?
Yes, I'd definitely be happy to. The National Alliance to End Homelessness is a nonpartisan, mission-driven organization, and our, you know, real goal really is preventing and ending homelessness in the United States. We've been around since 1983 and, you know, have really sort of focused primarily on trying to affect federal policy, but also in sort of disseminating information at the local and statewide level so that organizations and communities can actually implement the programs that we're finding help to end homelessness. The Alliance sort of took a different a turn, if you will, about 10 years ago now, when we issued a 10-year plan to end homelessness. And that was sort of a national vision for how homelessness could be ended in communities across the country. And that really has served as our sort of strategic plan, if you will. And a big element of that strategic plan was that we also, as a part of that 10-year plan, came up with what we call 10 essentials for ending homelessness. And those were really the blueprint that communities around the country, and right now we count about 230 or 34 communities around the country who have developed 10-year plans to end homelessness, and they use that as a blueprint. And I'm happy to say that it's really that blueprint that really has led to the development of or the inclusion of measures that were included in the, you know, what gets measured, gets done toolkit for performance measurement. A lot of the measures that you'll see relate directly to one of the elements of the 10 essentials. So rapid rehousing, which is the process of getting people out of shelters very quickly after they show up there and back into housing. That is a particular programmatic approach that we know ends homelessness. And so it's also one of the examples that's included in the toolkit, and there are measures included there in terms of the percentage of people who are actually diverted from shelter or who left shelter in very short periods of time. And the same thing can be said for other elements like the creation of permanent supportive housing. And also, if you look at that as a measure, also looking at the percent of people over time who are retained after 1 year, 2 years, 3 years into permanent housing, emergency prevention and systems prevention, and also increases in income. All of those that I'm naming are elements of the 10 essentials and of the 10-year plan to end homelessness, and all of those have analogs within the toolkit. And because one of the goals of the toolkit was to provide to either the communities, whether it be at the state level, the municipality level, or even at the program level, to provide those communities who are, you know, listening to our blueprint for how to end homelessness, to give them examples of how they can really be measuring performance in their own individual programs.
That is such a powerful thing. I mean, aside from just that wonderful cause of ending homelessness, to be thinking through it so clearly and to have those 10 essentials, it really is a very powerful way to start. And I guess that kind of leads into our first point, Bill, is something that I think is very, very important to start with before we ever talk about measures, is to talk about the results, to talk about the outcomes, you know, like those 10 essentials. What is the difference that we're really trying to create? And really, that's a good motto, I think, in general. You know, talk about results before you talk about measures. So, Bill, what are the outcomes that the, or a sample of them, if you like, the outcomes that the Alliance decided were worth measuring for ending homelessness? Can you take us through a range of those?
Yes. And I guess I can, you know, maybe I'll start actually at a system sort of level, because that's the sort of level that the Alliance most, closely looks, sort of at our national system. And so one of the things, for example, that we are often looking at in terms of the national system is whether or not there have been declines in the incidence of homelessness. Given that homelessness is measured across the country on a biannual basis here, is that happening? Is that impact, actually occurring? Another is looking at reductions in the length of stay that people spend homeless or in temporary housing, because we know that when people spend shorter amount of time in temporary housing, one, we know that we can have actually a smaller homelessness system. We also know that people have more successful outcomes if the system is working to get them out of shelter and into permanent housing. Another measure is the prevention of first-time homelessness, so looking at homeless individuals, and if you have good data systems to track whether or not those individuals have experienced homelessness before, to look at whether or not there have been reductions in first-time, or if the percentage of first-time homelessness is relatively low. And lastly, a reduction in recidivism, which, you know, means exactly what it means in sort of a criminal justice sort of setting, but here in the homelessness setting, of reducing the amount of the number of people who actually return to homelessness after having been served by the homelessness assistance system. So a lot of, you know, the Alliance itself is looking at measures like that to see what is happening at the national level in the homelessness system. Individual communities are also looking at similar system-wide measures like that. But also, you know, communities are also looking at what we would sort of say are programmatic level measures as well. So if you're running a particular kind of program, like one of the kinds of programs I mentioned that's in our 10 Essentials, like a prevention program, you might look at an example program outcome would be the percent of individuals who are diverted from shelter, that is, that they would have otherwise become homeless without the intervention, and the percent who are diverted due to prevention assistance. Another example would be if you were operating a different kind of program, say a permanent supportive housing program, you might look, and I mentioned this I think briefly before, you might look at the percentage of individuals who are placed into permanent supportive housing, and that's housing with supportive services, who stayed there for a year or longer. And I think, you know, we know from some information from individual communities across the country that about 84% of individuals who are placed in the permanent supportive housing programs remain there after a year. So being able to, that's another measure that for that particular kind of program. And so I think it brings up the point that in most of these instances, or in many of these instances, the measures that you're looking at are really program-specific. Permanent supportive housing has that particular goal of retention. But it's also true that in some of the other programs, you know, in an employment program, you're going to have very different kinds of outcomes that you're looking at, like the percentage of individuals or the percentage of individuals who either maintained or increased their employment over time, for example, in an employment training program. Again, income and increasing income is one of those 10 essentials that we know ends homelessness. And while those two kinds of programs, supportive housing and employment, might have very different outcomes that you're looking at, outcome measures, you might, if you look at a rapid rehousing program, for example, it also is going to have an outcome similar to permanent supportive housing, that is, the number who remain in housing at 12 months. But we're also likely to look at the number who remain at shorter intervals, like 6 months, as well, because, you know, we're for that particular kind of program where there's less intensive services, we want to know whether or not even people are staying for even shorter periods of time. So in part, it depends on what kind of intervention you're talking about, but there are certain interventions that we know across the board, like length of stay in shelter, that all matter.
That's really what you're talking about there, Bill, is a almost like a, maybe it's not a hierarchy of outcomes, but it's certainly thinking about outcomes at various levels. Like you mentioned the national system, that big broad view. You also mentioned community level, where some of the things that you'd be looking at that community level people would be looking at would be similar to what you'd be looking at on a national scale, but also at the community level, I think you talked about how you start bringing in some of the program-specific type outcomes and measures as well. So it really is a very complex, or not, maybe it's not complex, but it's a very thorough system of thinking about homelessness and how to look at homelessness and how to look at those factors that end it. So something that I'm really curious about is how did that evolve? Where did these outcomes come from? What process did you guys use to figure out what are maybe the 10 essentials and what are the kinds of outcomes that people will find are very valuable to track and measure toward ending homelessness?
Right. And I think that there's a number of sources for that. You know, one of the sources, particularly as it relates to the 10 essentials, is a lot of investigation and research that individuals at the Alliance and even, you know, individuals in other organizations who are doing research that really look to figure out what worked for particular populations. And so a lot of investigation of what people were doing in individual communities. And in a lot of instances, there might be a couple of pioneer communities that are, you know, pioneering certain kinds of interventions, like a housing first model, which is a model that might be combined with an outreach model where you go out and find people on the street, and instead of offering them, you know, shelter, you offer them permanent housing. Well, you know, there were you know, sort of seminal initial studies that showed that that sort of approach was effective. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, permanent housing, for example, is one of the 10 essentials. The same is true a lot about, you know, a lot of the rehousing, rapid rehousing, and the other interventions that maybe target families. We had a document called Promising Strategies for Ending Family Homelessness that really did look at research to show just what are the interventions that are effective at reducing, ending, preventing family homelessness. And so one of the places where a lot of the intervention strategies came from was that sort of investigation. Another place where it came from was, you know, also sort of more systematic researchers by researchers, you know, by researchers in the field, you know, people like Dennis Cohen at the University of Pennsylvania and Martha Burt at the Urban Institute, who, you know, did a lot of theoretical, you know, sort of advanced the theory and understanding, and advanced the idea that reducing length of stay, for example, was critical to ending homelessness, and some of the other, you know, sort of seminal ideas about what needs to happen, the importance of prevention, for example, at ending homelessness. And so I think that there had to be, just as there had to be sort of some investigation about what interventions worked, and that's partly what informed some of the measures and some of the 10 essentials. Also, that sort of theoretical, sort of upper level kind of thinking, conceptual thinking about what the programs, what the system will look like to end homelessness, that was also very critical as well. And I would say, you know, one thing that can't be ignored, you know, what definitely can't be ignored in this example and maybe in other examples that people on the call are, you know, used to thinking about, is that, you know, the government, for example, requires that communities that receive certain forms of funding for homelessness assistance and prevention, they require that organizations collect within homelessness management information systems, electronic systems, that they collect certain data elements, and recently have started to require that they measure certain outcome measures, and even further have sort of introduced some incentives for so-called high-performance communities. So, you know, some of those incentives are, you know, if a community has a length of stay on average of less than 20 days, there are financial incentives for communities as it relates to getting additional funding for preventing their system. And so I think it's important not to forget that one of the anchors that exists here in terms of measurement, and one of the things I like about the measures that are actually in the toolkit and that in general are measured, things like length of stay are all measures that are derived from the basic universal set of measures that all communities are measuring. Whether or not somebody returns to homelessness is also a measure that's easily derivable from just the basic measures that are included in homeless management information systems, what we call HMIS systems. And so I think that it's important to acknowledge that on one end of the spectrum we have sort of the conceptual thinking that has us say that, well, prevention is important, reducing length of stay is important. At the other end of the spectrum we have, well, what is this base level of information that we're going to be collecting about people? And in the middle, then we have sort of these interventions that people are doing, these and the program evaluations that they're doing on those interventions that let us know what are effective strategies. If a strategy hasn't been shown to be effective, then it's not going to make it into, you know, our 10 essentials, and it's not going to then make it as a measure. There's not going to be a measure for it in the outcomes toolkit.
It shows that really important balance in how to decide which outcomes matter. You don't just sit there and brainstorm them. You don't just sit there and think just conceptually about what are the important outcomes and what should be measured and tracked. There's a very important part of what you've said, Bill, which is it has to actually be proven to work on the ground. You've got to see results from it. And that's like that testing and tracking and testing and tuning kind of concept. You know,
right.
We get the great ideas about what could work, but it's not until we really see how they're going on the ground that we decide whether they're worthwhile giving a lot of attention to. That gives a lot of rigor to those 10 essentials, I imagine.
Yes, and you know, I think that it's you know, when we look over time, what we're starting to see is that the more mature interventions that, you know, exist in the 10 essentials or that, you know, exist in other sort of recommendations on how to end homelessness, that the more mature of those have been shown over time to be, have been proven, you know, over time to be successful methods or interventions. Actually, earlier this year, there were a couple of studies in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is a pretty prestigious journal over here, about the cost savings associated with permanent supportive housing as opposed to taking care of those individuals within the homelessness system with emergency room visits and, you know, emergency shelter visits and time spent in jail. And so I bring that up mainly to indicate that that I think there's two things that are required. Yeah, the ideas need to exist. There needs to be some proof that those interventions work. And then I think there needs to be a further for lack of a better term, solidifying of those interventions as best practices, so that they, you know, continue to become the kind, they continue to proliferate, I guess is basically the word I'm looking for there, is that oftentimes you need to, one of the things that's important about performance measurement is that even though you're doing a proven method, intervention, practice, it's often important to continue to prove that it works, both so that you know that you're doing it right and that you're getting the kind of outcomes that others are getting, but also because it also advances the field and it allows, you know, others to know that, oh, this is really something that works. The body of evidence is so broad that it's hard to think of doing anything else.
It's fantastic. I love the thought that's been put into it, the seriousness that's given to it. I mean, it's a very serious topic, so treating the measurement side of it has to be serious as well. I'm just thinking of all these questions I want to ask you, but also need to keep to time, yeah. So I'll try and be really, really strict with myself.
Okay.
Hopefully one of our listeners will ask a question for me. You talk very naturally, Bill, about what are the outcomes that matter and what are the measures of them, and they just roll off your tongue. It's like, and I'm not sure if this is true or not, and it doesn't really matter, but it's like every single measure to do with ending homelessness you've got there in your mind. Those measures came from somewhere, and I know that from reading the toolkit that there is a, well, I guess I'd call it a simple formula, but it's a little four-step process that...
Right.
Very elegantly and simply and logically helps people work out, if you've got an outcome, how do you arrive at a measure for that outcome? Now, everybody loves a simple formula, particularly when it comes to measuring very intangible outcomes. Bill, I'd love for you to explain that outcome calculation model to us. Just take us through the steps and how it works, because that's really where many of the measures came from, isn't it?
Yes, and certainly all of the measures that show up in the toolkit adhere to this simple format and simple formula. And it's interesting that you bring that up. I don't know that it, as you were talking, it occurred to me how, I think you mentioned in my bio that I had come to the Alliance from what's called in the States a federally qualified health center in Washington, D.C., and did performance measurement and quality measurement, quality improvement. And a lot of times there were some measures that would fit into this, most of the measures would actually fit into this format, but there were often a few floating around that had to be measured slightly differently. But I think for the most part, in that setting or in the current setting, this formula works. I wasn't necessarily using it then and kind of wish I was. but basically here's how it works, is that you start in step one with asking yourself the question that who is the base population for your goal. So who is it that you want to help? And you might look at who your existing programs serve as a good place for that in the context of social service programs. And then in step two, and so you save that number of who you want to help and how many of those people there are. And then in step two, you want to ask, what did you hope to achieve with this population? And this is, goes back to parts of, early parts of this conversation where we're talking about being very intentional about, you know, what kind of outcomes you're looking at or what it is that you want to achieve. So what do you want those people to happen with those individuals? And then in step three, what we want to look at is, so within our population, so within our base population, how many people achieved that thing that you wanted them to achieve? And so that last item, looking at the number of people that achieved what you wanted them to achieve, serves as a numerator. And then the first item that we talked about, which was what's the size of the base population that you for your goal, serves as the denominator. And the calculation that we use for all of the measures that are in this toolkit is basically that numerator of how many people achieve the goal divided by the size of the base population for that goal. And so, you know, one example of using that might be looking at permanent supportive housing, which is an intervention that we advocate for the about 20% of the homeless population. It's considered chronically homeless. It's been homeless for, you know, a long period of time or multiple times, and also has a disability, either physical or psychosocial. And so our base population, for example, for that sort of intervention would be only those individuals that, you know, that are in your existing programs that meet that criteria of being chronically homeless. And then what you want them to achieve is that you want them to be stably housed in housing with services. And certainly you want them to be primarily stably housed. And then in step three, you want to look at what fraction or how many of your the people, how many of these chronically homeless individuals in your base population actually were able to achieve that. And the example I gave before is that how many were achieving that in a year. And so if you started with about 100 individuals who were chronically homeless and you kept that aside for your denominator, and then you made your step, you made your way through steps two and three and identified that 80 of those individuals actually were stably housed in a year's time, then you would end up with this 80% outcome there, that 80% were stably housed after a year. And that's, you know, basically the simple model and an example of how to use it.
The real power is in steps one and two, isn't it? It's getting really, really clear about who your population really is and defining that population as specifically as possible. And then in step two, being very clear about what you want that population to achieve in such a way that you'd be able to observe them achieving it. You'd be able to somehow detect or see or observe the extent to which people are achieving it. So again, with step two, you need to be quite specific as well. You can't be vague or wishy-washy with your language. You can't use vague words like people are more effectively housed. You have to be very clear about what you mean by stably
right.
housed. Does that sound?
Yes, no, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, I think that, you know, specifically as it relates to part one, who is your base goal, you know, base population for the goal, one of the things that we often talk about at the Alliance is the issue of targeting. And, you know, one of the things that's particularly a challenge in the social service world is that everybody that you encounter as a potential client in that world, or in the, you know, in homelessness, social services in general, is in need, and often can benefit from a service that you provide. And I think callers may recall me saying earlier, I was using an example of a measure, and I was talking about prevention. It was like the percentage of individuals who would have become homeless without the intervention. And that's a specific example that we talk about a lot with targeting, is making sure that, for example, a prevention intervention, which might involve a cash transfer or a sort of short-term subsidy of somebody's existing housing, That may benefit a wide range of people, but if it's not targeted to people who would otherwise have become homeless, then that's not really your target population, and you may not see the kind of success, or you may see the success, but it may not be actually measuring what you intended to measure, which is the prevention of homelessness. And then the same thing, you're exactly right. In step two, it's very important to be very clear about what status or situation people are in at a given point in time to indicate whether or not, you know, they've achieved success. I think that's having clarity about that is very important.
Fantastic. So I think I still believe it's just such a simple and powerful formula. So if anyone out there is stuck and you're just not sure how to develop measures of your own program outcomes, use that formula as a starting point. It's a great thinking process, and for it to end up at step four with the measure right there in front of you, it's brilliant. Bill, you've already been sharing some great examples of programs and program outcomes and measures. And I'm sure that with everybody listening, some of those they'll recall and some of them will still be swimming through their heads. So I'm just hoping that we could spend maybe a few minutes going over a few other examples of particular Right. measures for various programs, just to sort of get that sample nice and clear. Choose whichever programs you want to. I think when we were planning the call, we might have talked about prevention, emergency shelter, employment training, and a few others. But would you mind doing that, Bill, sharing just some more examples of different programs and their measures?
Yes, yeah, no problem. Yeah, I'd be happy to. One of the things that I think might be interesting for me to talk about in that regard is that, I talked a little bit about prevention and gave an example of a measure there. I talked about permanent supportive housing. I talked about rapid rehousing. And those represent some of the, you might call innovative interventions, sort of the standard traditional homelessness assistance system is often made up of emergency shelter and transitional housing. And I think it's maybe important for me to reiterate that there are goals and there are outcomes related to those traditional systems, and we do believe that those systems will continue to be a part of the system to end homelessness. And so, for example, if you are, if an individual or if a program is an emergency shelter program, there are some sample outcome measures that would be important to look at for those kinds of programs. And so one of those is length of stay. So, we have percent who exited to permanent housing. And it's important to clarify, and this gets into your item about step two of the four-step process. So people who exited not to a temporary situation, but to a temporary housing in less than 30 days and do not present for shelter again within 12 to 24 months. And so that's a measure that we identify for emergency shelter, because both ends of that are very important. One, getting people into permanent housing quickly, and also making sure that giving those people enough services that they don't return within 12 or 24 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's another one that we have here is for traditional, emergency shelter program, the percentage with histories of living on the streets. And so, again, in your step one, you want to start off with making sure that you have an assessment that identifies those who have a history of living on the streets, and then the percentage of them who remain in emergency shelter or another housing. And so that's an example where if people are on the streets, having them in shelter is a benefit. Having them not on the streets where there's a lot of risks, homeless people are killed on the streets, people die of accelerated natural causes on the streets. And so, that particular measure gets at that particular street population, the percentage of them that you're able to keep in either emergency shelter or in housing. And you might give that a time period of 6 months, 12 months, or some longer period that you might want to look at that. you know, the percent who are connected with a primary case manager, because a lot of people who are receiving services also need to continue to receive services. And something that I didn't talk about, which is which is connection to what we call mainstream services, that are services that are not a part of the homelessness system. You know, so what percentage of people are connected to a primary case manager that can actually connect them to those services? And then another measure that derives directly from that is the percentage who actually applied for mainstream benefits for which they appeared eligible. And so that's another example where in step one you might identify what individuals here that are in my shelter are eligible for what we call mainstream benefits. And for families, that might be what we would call TANF benefits, or for somebody with a disability might qualify for some Social Security disability benefits, a financial benefit. And what you're looking at in step three is looking at what number of those individuals who are eligible actually applied for those services, and you might actually further develop another measure that looked at the percentage who actually received those services, for example. So that's an example of, you know, four or five different measures that would apply to a traditional emergency shelter program, for example. And, you know, I think I may have mentioned an example of income in an employment training program, where you're looking at probably two kinds of measures, or a few different measures. You might actually look at some output measures there. So the percentage of individuals or the number of individuals that received certain kinds of training. They might receive some sort of basic employment training, and you might also measure the number of individuals that receive some specialized training. That's more of an output or process measure. But then you would also want to look at the percentage that were actually to be able to be employed within, you know, maybe 30 days, looking at a short-term outcome, and then amongst the population that actually was employed, looking at the percentage of individuals that were able to retain employment at various intervals, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, or beyond.
Fantastic. Bill, I'm just noticing a couple of people, Peter and Jerry, have popped in the same question, and I thought we might just stop quickly and so I can ask it of you, because it might help them immediately and to clarify for anyone else out there who might be confused about it too. We've been talking about the different steps in the outcome calculation, and step one was the getting really clear about who your target population is, or who you're trying to help. Step two was what is the difference you're trying to make for them, what do you want them to achieve. The third step was how many people achieved it, and the question that Jerry and Peter and possibly others are asking is, can you remind us what step four is? I mean,
right. So step four is really just the division that of the outcome of step one by the outcome of step, or the outcome of step three by the outcome of step one. So step four is simply the calculation step, where your numerator there is the number of people that actually received the intervention, the number of people that actually achieved the goal. And then in step one, it's actually the number of people who were your base population for that goal. And so it's dividing the number who achieved it by overall number who were sort of eligible, who you wanted to achieve the goal. And that's what gives you your outcome, which can be represented as a fraction or what we normally do as a percentage.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Bill. I hope that helps, Jerry and Peter. Thank you for asking that question. Good. So Bill, we've talked about a sample of program measures for emergency shelter. We've talked about several measures for employment.
Great.
That sounds good. We're sort of just keeping track of time. We could easily keep moving. Did you want to talk about another program, though, before we do keep moving?
I might just go back and sort of reiterate some of the things that I talked about earlier. I sort of touched on. So, for example, I mentioned prevention earlier. And there would be, you know, a number of individuals. For example, in step one, you might be identifying individuals who, through an assessment, and there are several places around the country who are using these so-called, you know, self-sufficiency matrices that might help them to be able to identify how both how at risk people are for homelessness, but also the likelihood that they could remain housed if they were given some sort of short-term assistance. So, for example, based on some assessment like that, you might identify a pool of people who are at risk for homelessness. You'd identify your goal, which is that they never become homeless. And then you might also track over time, once you actually provide those people with the intervention, which is often either a short-term subsidy or it might be some, you know, providing them with money for first and last month's rent and, you know, whatever the, you know, the services are that they need, the financial assistance that they need, and then tracking at very regular intervals to see whether or not they were able to remain housed or whether or not they were kept from going into shelter. And that's certainly an important intervention in the towards ending homelessness. I think I also talked about outreach programs, and one of the things that I may have mentioned it briefly, I don't know how much I talked about it, but you know, one of the measures that we might look at there is the percentage of individuals who are linked to appropriate community services. Because a lot of times there are services available for individuals, it's just that they're not accessing them. You might look at the percentage of individuals. In particular, we have a clarification in our toolkit, the percentage of so-called service-resistant individuals who are engaged by a team. So these are people who haven't been able to be engaged by others before, and what fraction of those individuals, you know, are able to be actually engaged by a mobile outreach a team, because mobile outreach is a big part of actually getting to the very people that you need to get to, particularly when we start talking about street homeless populations or chronically homeless populations who may not be presenting themselves for services elsewhere.
I'm glad you mentioned this third example of prevention, Bill, because it sort of highlights in my mind the importance when you are trying to track the outcomes of a particular program, or you're trying to track a vision such an important vision of ending homelessness, that you don't just think about the interventions that you're making. You have to think about how you can prevent people from even needing the kind of help, from even getting into the situation where they need help. So it's that whole prevention idea is very important. The response idea, I guess, which is what a lot of the programs are aimed at, is, you know, people who are facing homelessness, or you know, helping them get out of that situation. But the third aspect is the follow-up, the sustainability kind of end of it, where it's, you know, making sure that any of the interventions that you take people through stick, that it makes a difference in their lives, and it's a difference that they can sustain. I'm not sure if that's a standard kind of approach for outcomes, but it just became suddenly very apparent to me in the examples that you gave, Bill, that prevention, the intervention, and also the ensuring that it's sustainable.
Right. And I think two things related to that. I mean, one of the things that's important is that, you know, that concept does extend outside of just you know, the sort of social service realm, or the sort of most vulnerable. I was at a workshop recently when they were talking about foreclosure, which, you know, is affecting, because of, you know, the economic circumstances affecting lots of people, a lot of people who are, you know, vulnerable to losing their homes, but probably not vulnerable to homelessness per se. And they were showing the percentage of individuals who end up in default after receiving a loan modification. And I was surprised that, I think, at 1 month after a loan modification, I think the percentage of individuals who received one who were back in default was about 40%, which seemed,
wow,
you know, high to me. Like, oh, wow. You know, you would think that, you know, people who receive the modification would be, you know, able to sort of sustain it for some period of time. And so I think that this applies, even though this is still talking about sort of people who are in some form of economic vulnerability, you know, even outside of this sort of homelessness realm, it's the importance of being able to track what happens to people after they leave the program and whether or not they are able to sustain the gains is important. And then the other thing that you talked about that's also important is that when I talked about prevention just now, I was talking about it at a sort of at a programmatic level or at a sort of micro system level, meaning within the homelessness system. But there's also sort of a larger system issue about whether or not our existing programs that serve people that become homeless, whether or not they're working to prevent it as well. So there are often programs directed at poor, very poor families with children that are intended to keep them from being economically vulnerable or homeless. There's also programs for elderly populations to do the same thing. And the same thing for a whole host of populations that end up becoming homeless. There's a problem in this country of people being discharged from a variety of institutions, whether it be prison systems or foster care systems or juvenile justice, again, prison systems for youth. And those people ultimately ending up homeless. And so the question, there's a systems level, prevention level, is, you know, are these sort of systems that are supposed to discharge people into stable situations, are they working to prevent them from actually touching the homeless system? So that piece of prevention came to mind also as you talked about it as well. And I could see that there might be analogs to non-social service kinds of situations as well.
You know what, this really brings us to this idea of just how big and how large the whole system is around not just homelessness, but all sorts of social services, I guess, and the difference they're trying to create in our society and communities. And because of the interaction of all of these larger things, you know, the economic condition that we're in, the change in social, in cultures and values and changes the prison system, but I don't really mean that. I mean the way we treat and manage crime. And there's all sorts of things going on that can affect, like you say,
right,
how the pending homelessness programs are actually working. So this is a struggle that lots of people do have, is how to account for factors that are outside the designed control of the programs that they've designed to create their outcomes,
right,
or achieve their goals. They can only influence so much, but those other things can still sabotage the success. So, Bill, how does the Alliance go about doing this or handling this, evaluating the success of programs, despite the fact that in the broader context, there's things outside their control, things that can affect the results the measures are showing that aren't necessarily designed within the programs?
Right. And this is, you know, this is certainly an issue that's become, you know, very critical in the U.S. in the homelessness field in the last few years, because one of the pieces of good news that existed, one of the pieces of good news that exists is that between, for several years, for example, from, you know, 2005 to 2007, we were able to see that there were improvements at what we call outcomes impact level. In the toolkit we use, outcomes impact, which was that there were decreases in chronic homelessness. At the same time, during that period, there were increases in the intervention of the provision of permanent supportive housing. So we saw that there was progress, but that was all before the economic downturn and before we started to see providers seeing more homeless people, and before, as of a few weeks ago, we started to see new data that suggested that those decreases that had been existing, both not only for chronic but also for families who are homeless and other populations as well, that those decreases, you know, came to a halt, it appeared, in 08. and it's not clear what we're going to see for the current calendar year, what the data is going to show. But our suspicion is that it's going to that the problem is going to worsen. And so, you know, what you bring up about the broader context, both in terms of what's happening in terms of global economy, but also in terms of what's happening within systems, is very important. Another factor that's been very important in that regard is that just as communities have been hit hard with job losses that have led to more homelessness, they've also been hit hard with lower tax revenues, and so their ability to pay for services as at the community level has decreased. But that all that said, I mean, I think that one of the things that has led me to think about is the importance of the range of outcomes. I think that sometimes my experience has been is that there's a premium placed on sort of what we might call impact outcomes, which are how are you affecting the broader community, how are you affecting the broader company, how are you whatever the broader, you know, outer edge of the system is that you're looking at, what kind of impact you're having, how are you changing things at that sort of systemic level. And that has become sort of a holy grail in some, you know, sort of circles. But I think when you're in a circumstance where you have a lot of external factors that are impacting, particularly external factors that have changed, then I think the importance of sort of nearer term, sort of short term or intermediate term outcomes become very important. And I would further say that it's at that point that also the importance of output and process measures become important, because I think it's important to you know, for people who are both delivering services or, you know, in my case, you know, homelessness services, it's important for people who are delivering services and for people who are assessing the systems to still be able to know whether or not what you're doing is working. And sometimes process measures can tell you, well, are we still doing as much as we can, you know, given our limited resources? Are we still serving the number of people that we should be able to serve with this particular amount of funding, or are we still serving them in a way? And I, you know, haven't talked about process measures before, and we haven't talked about that. But you know, there's one thing to have output measures that are mainly measuring how many people you served. But certainly, in certain clinical fields that I've looked at, there are people who are measuring, for example, how you serve them. You know, did you do certain things along the way? So you might have a whole series of output measures that look at how you did it. And then again, at outcomes, you know, the sort of nearer term outcomes. Are people still housed after short periods of time? Are people actually getting employed? Are people getting the training? Because I think the more you're impacted by those outer things, you know, sort of the things that are outside of your control, the closer in you have to look, and, you know, meaning nearer to the intervention. So you might have to look at, you might have had the luxury to look at impact at one point. Now you might have to start looking at outcomes a little bit more, not just the impact outcomes. And or you may have been in a situation where you were looking at outcomes and seeing how those were progressing, but now you may have to look at some outcomes and some outputs and some process things as well. You know, to be able to know whether or not at least what you're doing is still having its intended effect, even if there's so many other things impacting you, you know, further down the line.
Very wise advice. I love that idea. I mean, this is why a system of measures is so important, not just to measure the end game or the lag measures, if you like, but also to measure those process measures, which are the drivers and often the lead indicators as well. In addition to being useful to help you at least get some gauge of the effectiveness when other factors are really sabotaging your outcomes, they're also really good drivers as well. And that's what we can affect, isn't it? I mean, it's by measuring the process, by measuring the intervention, that gives us the feedback and the tools to test and tune and make the intervention work as best as it possibly can.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to start inviting people to submit questions, Bill. I might do that, actually, and then sort of give you a few more moments to share some final points, if you like, and just give everybody a chance to type them in. But I will now invite everybody. If any of you do have a question for Bill, feel very welcome right now to submit that question to us using the Q&A form that's on our Measures and More webcast page. I can see a question's already come through, which is wonderful. Just type your question in there. You can stay anonymous if you want to, but use your name if you don't mind too. It's always nice when I'm talking to a person with a name when the questions come through. So type that in. And while everybody does that, feel free to tell us a little bit more, share some final points, and maybe even mention more about the toolkit on performance measurement for ending homelessness, because that's something that's available on the website, is it not?
Yes, and it's available on the website. Our website is endhomelessness.org, .org, and it is, the name of it is What Gets Measured Gets Done, a toolkit on performance measurement for ending homelessness, which was released about a year ago in July 2008. So I encourage people to go there. It's free and available. And the calculation that we were talking about, for example, is on page 25. And so people will see both the calculation, and on page 26 they go through an example of looking at, the percentage of a population that has remained housed for some period. And so it goes through some very specific examples that I think people will find valuable. It also talks about system-level outcomes that we've kind of been talking about, as well as program-level outcomes. The other thing that I wanted to actually mention, as questions are coming in, is that, one of the advantages of one of the opportunities, I should say, that we have, we had about a few weeks ago, actually, we had a national conference on ending homelessness in Washington, D.C., and there were about 1,300 people representing communities across the country, across the world even. I think there were some representatives actually from Australia at the conference. And one of the things that one of the opportunities that gives is that gives us to see how people actually are measuring their performance and measuring their successes. And last February we had a conference of that sort, and there was an individual that presented from a program, a company called Rubicon Programs out on the West Coast of the United States, and he talked very explicitly about some of the measurement successes that they had had, or the performance successes that they had had. And he gave, for example, an example where, in an employment example, where prior to their hire in a, because they actually, this program not only tries to get people employment, but they actually run social enterprises that they use to actually employ people. And so in their social enterprise program, they found that prior to the hiring, people earned on average $910 per hour before coming into their program. And that was from, some people were working and some people were getting a variety of disability benefits and things. And what he was able to show was that at 6 months that had jumped, not exactly doubled, but almost to about $1,700. And 1.5 years after being employed in the program, it had jumped to over $2,000. This is a monthly, salary. And so, I think that, one of the advantages or the benefits that I've been able to have is that while we sort of operate at this national level, we do have these opportunities like the conferences where people are able to show very specific, tangible, data-driven examples of exactly how they're, what kind of the successes that they're achieving. We also, the same program was able to demonstrate the sort of housing stability for people who were participating in their programs, and that introduced an interesting concept, which was the concept of benchmarks or objectives that, one of the objectives they had was that participants who had been placed in housing would remain, participants who had been placed in employment remain housed at various points, and one of them was at 13 weeks. And they had an objective of 75%, and they were able to show at during their presentation how in the years 06 and 07, they weren't able to meet that 75% benchmark, but through their performance improvement program, they were able to get those numbers up to 77%, which was above their 75% benchmark that they were trying to achieve, or objective that they were trying to achieve. So I just wanted to sort of throw that concept out there.
It's great. If you've got numbers like that, you can celebrate.
And, right.
That's an important part of this. I mean, it's making such a powerful difference in the lives of people. And to see that you're having real, significant, tangible success in making that difference in people's lives is definitely cause for celebration, and measures help us do that so much better than any other form of information that's far less objective. So, yeah, to see numbers like that changing is just so exciting. So that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that, those examples, Bill.
Great.
Shall we take some questions?
Yes, definitely.
Our first question is from George, and George is asking, Bill, did you face any challenges in getting other agencies to adopt the measures or implement them? If you did, how did you overcome them?
So, you know, that's a good question. I think that one of the big ways to sort of overcome this sort of obstacle, as I mentioned sort of in passing, I think, was that most of the measures that were, you know, discussed in the talk today and in the toolkit, while they require some analysis and programming and stuff to sort of extract the data, it's all derivable from sort of universally required measures in homelessness management information systems. And a large fraction of the country is covered by communities who either currently have those systems or have those systems in process. And so I think that a lot of the resistance that might have existed, in a lot of ways is sort of mitigated by the fact that, funding, the ability to get federal funding is sort of now tied, one, to has been increasingly tied to having these data systems in place, but also increasingly to, I had sort of mentioned briefly this notion of there was this definition of high performing community that was in the very recently enacted new legislation on homelessness, and it has, for example, a term of homelessness of less than 20 days being one criteria for being a high performing community. Another individuals or families who leave homelessness, that less than 5% of those individuals actually become homeless again within the next 2 years, so a recidivism kind of measure. And so I think that the toolkit itself is only about a year old, and there's been some recent developments in the last few months, at least driven by the economy in part and by changes in federal administration, that have led to a wider adoption of these kinds of strategies. So as a result, I think some whatever resistance that sort of existed there, I think is going to sort of be taken care of by that. I'm not sure if that's a satisfying answer, but yeah, that's...
we'll see. If George asks a follow-up question, I'll let you know, but okay. That sounds fine, Bill. Thank you. Our next question is from Peter, who is in Melbourne. Do you know where Melbourne is, Bill?
Yes.
Oh, great. well, imagine Melbourne, as you think of Peter. His question is, does the Kellogg Foundation concept of program logic form a basis for you using measures to directly improve and test program effectiveness? Now, Bill, I have to admit, I don't know of the Kellogg Foundation concept. Is this something that you're familiar with?
Yeah, and I think Kellogg has sort of certainly popularized or disseminated the logic model sort of framework in which you... it sort of is a, series of columns that, sort of have you go from the inputs to use to do in your program to, in the resources that you need for it, to the interventions, and making your way all the way to the right-hand column to your outcomes. And that's actually one of the, I think Kellogg actually does a good job, although most people use that sort of five-column logic model. The Kellogg toolkit for developing logic models actually introduces a couple of other frameworks. But yes, the logic model framework actually comes into play a fair amount in the toolkit, but actually another concept that comes into play that people may be less familiar with is something called the outcomes funding framework, which has, in this country anyway, has been popularized by an organization called the Rensselaerville Institute, and has been adopted by, I think, the Freddie Mac Foundation as their framework. And that's sort of a framework that operates on a funnel. We actually have pyramids in the toolkit, but sometimes in that original model, they often operated it, had it looking like a funnel. But the idea was the same, that you have some percentage of people that come into your program and only, you know, that, you know, you have some people come in, you sort of screen them, and maybe only some fraction are eligible, or even of the ones who are eligible, only a smaller fraction actually, you know, participate in the program. Amongst the ones that participate, only some maybe achieve the primary output that you're trying to achieve, whether it be graduation from a program or placement into a certain kind of housing. Amongst those people, then there's an even smaller fraction that might be remain in housing after so many times, or remain employed after so many months or some other time period. And then your ultimate outcome might be at the bottom, which is maybe you want people to either be stably housed at 3 years, or you want people to be employed or to have tripled their or doubled their income in 1.5 years. If that's your ultimate outcome, that's at the bottom of the funnel. And the idea, you know, that notion of sort of people receiving sort of both increasing benefit the longer that they're attached to the program is another concept that's actually, I think, heavily embedded into what's presented there. But the general answer to the question is that certainly there is a version of the a logic model that is the basis for a lot of this. But there's also other outcomes concepts, I think, that are sort of introduced as well.
When I think of a funnel like you've described, Bill, I think of conversion rates of people moving down that funnel. And like, I guess that could be very similar to some of those outcome measures, which are almost like conversion rates. Here's your target population. Here's the effect that you wanted to have with them. Here's the percentage that actually got the effect. I don't know if that's oversimplifying it, but funnels and conversion rates just seem to be tied together in my mind.
Right. No, I think that I think there is a direct analog there. And there's an example in the toolkit. I'm sort of paging through it now to see what page it is, but it uses that pyramid, and it shows it uses the basis, the denominator of the number of people who came in or who were originally deemed to be in the pool population, and sort of shows this decreasing a percentage that achieve this sort of higher and higher level of output or outcome. You know, that concept, I think, is there. There's this whole concept of either in that outcome funding framework where they talk about light touch versus heavy touch, or, you know, people that you've had the most impact with, or people that you've been able to touch the most with your program having the most benefit, or the concept of dosage, people that have gotten the most dosage of your program getting the most out of it. And so I think that concept, in addition to the sort of outcomes, you know, sort of logic model concept, sort of shows up in a variety of places throughout the document.
Such a rich thing. We've got time for one more question, Bill. So this question is from Jerry in Long Reach. Everyone's from Australia today. It must be too late in the US. Do you know where Long Reach is, Bill?
No, I don't know where Long Reach is. Where is it? Where is it?
It's in the outback, virtually.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, great.
Out in the middle of Queensland, I think. So, yeah, it's a fair way out in the bush, if you like.
Ah, okay.
Where the skies are huge and the ground is very flat and expansive. Jerry asks, you mentioned impact of programs. If I imagine a broad community benefit of decreased homelessness might be personal safety, how do you suggest something like that could be measured?
That's a good question. I mean, what comes to mind actually most readily, and this is only going to partly get at it, is that there's been a whole, and I mentioned this briefly when I talked about those two sort of articles in the American Medical Association, where there's been a fair amount of research into being able to show that people, for example, that are in permanent supportive housing, I can maybe mention two strains of research. One, that they utilize fewer public resources, and some of those resources are police resources that that certainly amongst the population, these studies often are looking at what we'd call the chronic inebriates, people who are, you know, heavy alcohol abusers who are on the streets and, you know, sleeping outside and occasionally needing to be taken to the emergency room and frequently needing to be taken to into jails to, quote-unquote, dry out and causing other, you know, quote-unquote, you know, public disturbances, also utilizing shelter services periodically and using a variety of services. But certainly some of the services that have been measured in those studies, and those studies have shown that that you can save, you know, thousands of dollars per homeless person, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars per homeless person, particularly for uncompensated medical care, but also for other things like those public safety services. It doesn't really get into the question of whether or not public safety, you know, has been improved, or measuring the impact to the broader community of public safety. But I think that that's even another frontier in the homelessness field, where we haven't really looked we've documented in some instances how we save communities money. And save, you know, by not having to pay for certain services that people were, expensive services that homeless people were utilizing before they became housed. But I think there is a whole frontier of sort of public benefit that's out there to be measured. And I honestly must say that, you know, it's not one that I think has been really, has been targeted. It also occurs to me that it might be the kind of thing where you'd have to do sort of research of, I'm sort of thinking of preference research of the public, and sort of asking how much, how much are you willing to pay for, you know, additional public safety, how much are you willing to pay to have your streets, you know, without homelessness people, you know, on them, and things like that, to sort of get at, the public willingness to pay for those services. But I'm not sure I have a more direct answer than that right now.
But it is a good point. I mean, these things are just so connected to so many other things, and at some point we have to make a choice about where does our attention go. And I mean, you guys clearly have done that largely with coming up with the ten essentials for ending homelessness. You've done a lot of thinking there, which is not to say, and I think you even alluded to it, that even a lot of the thinking about the outcomes that matter and how to measure them is evolving as time goes by and will continue to evolve. So I think even though your answer might not have directly been how do you measure the personal safety part of it, I think the answer that you gave is a very valuable insight in and of itself, Bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the question.
We are out of time, so we'll need to wrap up now. I want to thank everybody for joining in today. Bill, on behalf of our Measures and More members, sincere thanks again for joining us today and for sharing the Ending Homelessness Outcome Measures experience with us.
Thank you. I was glad to be here. I enjoyed it immensely.
Thanks for joining the call, everybody. I'll catch you all next month for more great performance measurement insights, practical tips, and time-saving resources. This is Stacey Barr signing off.